Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC New York Public Radio, this is Soundcheck On Demand. I'm John Schaefer. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open from American Express, presenting the interactive webcast event, Making a Name for Yourself. Kate and Andy Spade and Bobby Brown discuss their leap from business to brand, created by Open from American Express. Registration at openforumonline.com.
This is Soundcheck at 93.9 WNYC and online at WNYC.org. I'm John Schaefer. Used to be, if you wanted to be, say, the next Coldplay, you might rely on a manager or your record label's A&R guy to get your music out there. But lately, music publishers are getting in on the act. So what are music publishing houses? They're known for protecting copyrights and doing promotion for new artists. What are they doing nurturing new talent? To look into that question, we are joined today by Susan Butler. She's the legal affairs and publishing senior correspondent for Billboard magazine. Susan, you state right off the bat in your recent article that music publishing is the most misunderstood aspect of the business. How so?
It is. You know, first of all, a lot of people don't understand that when you hear a recorded song, there's two separate kind of intellectual property pieces. There's the composition and there's the sound recording. Now,
Speed of sound is a melody and a collection of chords and lyrics. That's the composition.
The composition is the arrangement of notes, the melody, the lyrics. So what's your favorite song?
Well, let's just take, I mean, this isn't my favorite song, but let's just stick with Speed of Sound, the Coldplay tune that we were just hearing.
So let's say you walk out in the hallway and you start humming it. You start singing it in your car. You're singing and humming the composition.
Right.
Now you hear Coldplay perform it. You're hearing the sound recording of that composition. So record companies normally work with the recording artists who are making the sound recordings, and music publishers typically work with the songwriters who are composing those compositions.
So the music publishers will deal with, most of the time, Lennon and McCartney and not with Harrison and Starkey, because most of the songs were written by John or Paul.
Exactly. And what happens is that the business of music publishing takes these compositions, and they may not be directly working with songwriters after a certain period of time. They may have thousands or tens of thousands of compositions. And what they do is that anytime there is a company, for example, that wants to use a recorded song for a commercial, for television, on radio to perform it, all of those companies then pay for use of the composition to the music publishers. So what has been happening, although they've been doing it for quite a while, but what is really noticeable now is that the major record companies that put out the recordings do not necessarily have the time and the resources to really take someone who may not sell right out of the box and help develop and nurture them. And music publishers have been doing this for a long time, independent and major publishers, but it seems like even more so now. You take a Coldplay, that was BMG Music Publishing, James Blunt, EMI Music Publishing. You know, James Blunt was working with EMI for 2 years before he got his record deal because none of the record companies thought they were ready to just sell out of the box.
And yet when you mention these publishing houses in just now and in the article, they are Warner, EMI, Sony. It's Sony ATV as opposed to Sony Records, but it sounds like these music publishers are the same companies as the major record labels.
Some of them are and some of them aren't. Some of them are have the same parent company. Some have been spun off. But there are literally tens of thousands of independent music publishers. Now, some music publishers do nothing more than collect royalties and pay songwriters and other owners. But there are literally thousands of independent publishers as well that work with songwriters. And, you know, songwriters who are also artists, songwriters who are also producers. And one of the ways that they develop them is they will perhaps hook them up with other songwriters to help develop how to write a song. Mm-hmm. Alyssa James is one. You know, she's very young and she needs some kind of nurturing to figure out the right structure.
So Alyssa James is someone that a consultant from one of these music publishing houses found on MySpace. She's 17, is that right?
Well, she was 16 at the time. She just turned 17.
My goodness. What a voice for a teenager. This is a little bit of a song called Can't Let Go from the rising Alyssa James.
I'm falling into space, counting down the hours for a million days. I know
All right, so this is Alyssa James. She's all of 17, and she is working with the major music publishing house known as Sony ATV. We're speaking with Susan Butler, who is Billboard Magazine's legal and publishing senior correspondent. So let me see if I get this straight. She's working with Sony ATV Music Publishing. That doesn't necessarily mean that she's going to end up on Sony Records.
Correct. In fact, what they have been doing, the publishers, they've been bringing her down. She lives in upstate New York. They've been flying her into New York on weekends. They've been hooking her up with some top hot producers in L.A. and New York. They're sending her to Sweden. And then they're going to help try to develop what sound is going to work best for her and co-writing and learning until she can really come out of the box. Now, they may not go after a record deal immediately for her. They may just say, let's see what happens with perhaps some videos, some television commercials, motion picture soundtracks, and then let's see who comes to us.
Well, that also seems to be one of the new business models, though, for the major record labels is, you know, let's try and get on TV, you know, get something on a commercial or a film score and you're golden.
You would think so, but you know, they've been doing it for years. It's just that they have not had the kind of attention that I think they're now getting. And for instance, there's Seth Lakeman, who's in the UK. He's had a major label deal before. He has kind of a folk music genre and then no longer had the label deal. He was nominated for a big award over in the UK for an album. And then EMI Music Publishing in the UK said, boy, we love this guy. And, you know, they sent us an email, a link to his video, and I pulled a couple guys at Billboard, Chuck Taylor, Michael Paoletta. I said, hey, guys, come over. Let's check this video out. And our mouths just dropped open. It was so amazing. And so his video's up on YouTube, and he's now has an indie label deal and waiting to see where it goes.
All right. Now, another example that you give in your article in Billboard is Joe Purdy. Joe will actually be here in our studio in September, on September 22nd. He is quoted in your article as talking about, you know, having the side benefit of really maintaining some control over his material because he's working with publishers who, in theory, are working for him as opposed to a record company.
Exactly. And, you know, it's going to be different with each songwriter and each publishing company. Some people like a lot of control over their songs. Other songwriters say, I'm open to learning. It's really going to be an individual case. And the five that are in the Billboard article were ones that I personally selected just from their music alone. Mm-hmm. And so we've got, you know, Cass Dillon, we've got the Dukes of Windsor from Australia. They're all phenomenal songwriter artists.
And this guy, Joe Purdy, and a song called Why Do I?
Won't us just get back home? I guess the company of strangers is better than drinking alone. Too tired to sing, walking down the street. Too many things I got running around my head. Can't put my thoughts to rest. The
think I will confess it.
Joe Purdy is the singer and songwriter. The song is Why Do I? And he has a deal with, is it Warner Chappell Music? That's the music publishing that he's working with. Mm-hmm. Susan Butler's my guest, Billboard's legal and publishing senior correspondent. And we're talking about how music publishing is really taking a lead role in nurturing young talent. Joe Purdy's in his mid-20s. You mentioned before, it's not that this is new, that music publishers are doing this, but has it reached a certain critical mass? Are there other market forces at work that suddenly have made this, you know, worthy of note?
I think so. One is the economics, I think, of the music industry itself, so that a lot of the major record companies at one time did go out and they would take the new artists and help nurture them and develop them. And I think the economics, especially with massive piracy, is limiting the kind of funds that they can spend on developing someone for a couple years before they potentially have a hit record. On the other hand, music publishers, I think, are saying we can kind of fill in that gap and are getting more attention doing that.
Now, that surprises me simply because when I think of piracy, I mean, what we consider music piracy basically involves copyright infringement. And that sounds like it would be really hitting the music publishers hardest of all.
Well, it does affect the music publishers and the songwriters as well. But when I'm talking about piracy, I think affecting a lot of the major labels, I'm looking as well at the CD piracy. And, you know, I guess just overall piracy is affecting a lot of the record companies and how much they can invest. Music publishers have other sources. For instance, when they license the compositions to television stations, they have more outlets than the CD and the digital file on an MP3 player.
Okay. Now, what's in it for the music publishers? Because presumably if a Joe Purdy or an Alyssa James goes on to become a big star, it will be for someone else. It'll be for the label, not necessarily for the publishing house. What's their back end?
Because it's still their composition. So if it's a songwriter artist, it's still that artist's composition. So every time there's a record made, there's a bit of a royalty that goes to the music publisher and the songwriter as the artist. Every time that recording appears on a television station, every time a radio station wants to perform it, there's a royalty that goes to the music publisher for use of that composition.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned before that the publishing houses have a lot more of a playing field than the record companies, mm-hmm. perhaps because of all the different media that are out there now. So this is a growth industry in a larger business that seems to be kind of in the doldrums at the moment.
It absolutely is. In fact, a lot of the piracy that has hit the record companies so hard, most of the music publishers have been able to stay level because they have the other sources of revenue. And they're continuing to look for those sources of revenue in ringtones, ringbacks, all the different kind of wireless opportunities. So it's a huge potential market as long as everyone can keep a handle on piracy.
All right. Now, piracy, you know, can sometimes be in the eye or ear of the beholder. There are a number of websites where guitarists will go online, they've figured out how to play a song, and they will post online the chords for that song. Music publishers, a trade group representing the large music publishers, has recently gone after these guitar tablature sites and you know, threatened to sue them, to get them down. Now, since you sort of have delineated for us the two different copyrights, I understand that this is, in theory, a violation of the composition copyright.
Mm-hmm. An infringement.
Mm-hmm. But a lot of these websites, when you look at them, they'll say, you know, it's for educational purposes only, just to teach you how to play the song. How strong a legal leg do the music publishers have in this action that they're taking against these websites?
I think they probably have a very good position. What a lot of people don't realize is that lyrics are, for instance, lyrics or the tablatures are part of the composition, and therefore it's a copyrighted work that you need permission to use. Now, a lot of people are going to say it's fair use, and therefore I can just use it. And one of the categories for fair use is educational, but that's misunderstood. Educational is only one factor that's considered for fair use. And it doesn't mean that because, you know, you, for instance, write a book that you use in school, doesn't mean that book's going to be free.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So the fact that maybe you've sat down with the record and you've figured out for yourself the chords and now you want to share them with other guitars, that doesn't fall under the root. That's not protected. That's not, free speech.
Well, you know, I think that there's a difference. If you're sitting down with a friend and you're going to share it is one mm-hmm. thing. Let's face it, posting something on the internet's not sharing it with your neighbor or friend. I think there's some point where you go beyond just the casual sharing.
Okay. Now, Susan, as you look, I mean, we talked about, you know, music publishing as growth, general industry kind of flat right now. As you look ahead, do you see a potential for a music industry that is not built around records and record sales, but, you know, built around kind of the age-old model of live music, of musicians, you know, playing in either an actual live setting or a virtual one, and the recording, the actual document of a single performance being kind of an ancillary thing?
Well, I think that that's now. I think that there are just a lot of different ways to get music out there. Live music, let's face it, to put somebody on the road is very expensive to try to sell concert tickets. I mean, you can look at some of the top acts, and in some cities, they just don't sell out. Sitting down on a YouTube and getting it to people, yeah, that's one avenue. I think you lose out on the intimate experience that you might have in a small club or sometimes the excitement of a large auditorium. But I think between wireless media, digital, internet, there's just going to be so many choices. And that to me is very exciting because I think music publishers, artists, record companies have opportunities that they never have before as long as people can get a handle on where's the balance between sharing with a few people and sharing it with a million
potentially
others.
Everybody, right.
Yeah.
All right. Susan Butler's article in Billboard is about the rise of music publishers as kind of handholders, nurturers, facilitators for emerging talent. And one of the other bands, as you've already mentioned them, Susan, is this Australian rock group called Dukes of Windsor. They have signed with Universal Music Publishing Group. And we'll conclude with a little bit of their music, someone that you think we might be hearing more of down the line, not necessarily on Universal Records, though.
Exactly. I think they're hot, and I think you're going to hear a lot of these guys.
All right. Susan Butler picking the hits on Soundcheck this afternoon. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Coming up in a moment, Pluto may no longer be recognized as an official planet, but it does still have an orchestra piece named after it, thanks to British composer Colin Matthews. He'll join us to talk about that piece, which he wrote back in 2000. And later, a live performance by one of Zimbabwe's most beloved pop singers, Oliver Mutukudzi. You can email us. We're happy to hear your thoughts on some of the discussions we have on Soundcheck. Our email address is soundcheck@wnyc.org. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Last week's news that Pluto has been booted off the list of planets disturbed more than just a few astronomy buffs. The British composer Colin Matthews paid homage to the newly demoted dwarf planet in his 2000 composition, Pluto the Renewer, which you're hearing in the background. The piece was actually written as an addition to Gustav Holst's famous suite, The Planets, written back in 1914, when, of course, Pluto had not yet been discovered. Joining us on the phone from London with his reaction to Pluto's downsizing is the composer, Colin Matthews. Colin, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Your reaction to the news of Pluto's fate? You couldn't have been too surprised. You actually...
I wasn't surprised. I'm disappointed, like quite a few astronomers seem to be. But I'd always, in fact, in my original program note for the piece, I wrote that Pluto might well be declassified at some point. So, no, I wasn't surprised.
So did you have, I mean, when you were asked to, quote-unquote, complete Holst's planets by adding Pluto, did you approach that project with some trepidation, some mixed feelings?
Yes, I did. I wasn't sure whether it was something I could do. Particularly because I know the planets very well. I edited, in fact, a score of it with Holst's daughter Imogen back in 79, so I know the work inside out. And I took it on because I felt that because I know the work well, perhaps if anybody was going to do it, I might be the best person to do
mm-hmm.
it.
And you'd had some experience completing other people's works, hadn't you? Didn't you work with Derek Cook on the...
I worked on Mahler's 10th Symphony, yes, for many years with Derek Cook, which was an amazing project.
Mm-hmm.
And I've also been involved with some of editing some of Britten's unfinished works. So, you know, it's a familiar territory for me.
Well, so the challenge is that you're appending a new work onto a classic written at a different time in a
yep.
different style by a different fellow.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to be kind of true to the spirit, but you also, you're Colin Matthews. You have to sound like Colin Matthews when you do it.
You've summed up exactly what I felt. And, of course, there is the, you know, I didn't feel I was doing anything to the piece that was irretrievable because you don't have to play it. But it was this balance of trying to be myself but writing something which wouldn't be incongruous. And I certainly didn't set out to write a sort of pastiche version of Holst or to imitate. But I think in the process of writing it, I came a little closer to Holst than I was expecting to. I mean, it happened really without my intending to be that way.
Well, the original suite, The Planets, ends with Neptune the Mystic, very kind
yeah.
of formless, mystical-sounding music, which you kind of take as the starting point for your piece. Let's give folks a chance to hear how the original piece by Gustav Holst sounds as it comes towards its end. All right, Neptune the Mystic, Gustav
yes.
Holst's suite from 1914 called The Planets. You don't actually use the female chorus, but that sense of a kind of floating quality to the music, is that something that you took as a starting point?
Well, as a starting point, but I felt that, you know, unless I took the whole, the female voices were off stage, and I felt that unless I took the whole orchestra off stage, I couldn't do anything that was going to be more remote. And I took the decision to write a piece that was not slow. I mean, it had to be fast, I felt, as a contrast. So it's very fast and fleeting, and I thought perhaps of the image of solar winds and the strange, perhaps, comets, you know, exploding at the fringes of the universe, at the solar system.
So you called the piece Pluto the Renewer. Where does that come from? Pluto, I thought he was the scary guy. Where does the Renewer come from?
I tried to read through a book on the astrological significance of Pluto, and I gave up about 10 pages into this volume of 650 pages. But I did pick up the idea that the astrological significance of Pluto had to do with renewal, so it seemed to be... I could have read further and found out greater detail, but that was enough.
That was enough to go on. Here's some of the piece, Pluto, the Renewer. My guest is composer Colin Matthews. Some music by my guest Colin Matthews, written for the now-demoted dwarf planet of Pluto. Colin, as I mentioned earlier, this piece written to, quote-unquote, complete the planets, the famous suite by Gustav Holst. Pluto was discovered during Gustav Holst's own lifetime. Now, you knew his daughter, Imogen Holst, quite well, and aren't you also an administrator for the Holst Foundation?
Yes, I am. Yes.
So, do you know if Holst himself ever considered adding a Pluto movement of his own?
There's absolutely no record of Holst even having taken any notice of the discovery of Pluto, strangely enough, and certainly no correspondence, you know, whether a journalist would have asked him, you'd have thought automatically they would have done, but there's absolutely no record of that at all.
Well, Pluto,
it's certainly not the sort of thing he would have done. He was a very self-contained composer and person, and I think, you know, the last thing he wanted to do himself would have been to add another movement at such a distance in time.
But you felt okay doing it?
I didn't feel entirely okay, but I did it.
It was a gig. You did it.
Yes.
So you did it, and now suddenly Pluto is not on the accepted list of astronomical bodies that we call planet. Are there other Pluto supporters out there you can commiserate with?
Well, I don't know what to think. I mean, I suppose ethically I should withdraw the piece and refuse to allow it to be performed. But it's, you know, the interesting thing is that actually Simon Rattle, who's just recorded the piece with the Berlin Philharmonic, has been playing it on its own recently without the planets. So perhaps it will have an independent life of some sort.
So maybe then, Colin, you need to write a suite called The Dwarf Planets.
Indeed, yes.
Add Cirrus and Charon and yes. all the NGC 337s or whatever is all floating out there. Well, you know, Björk has written a song called Pluto, and the folk singer Christine Lavin's song Planet X in 1996 was a kind of a good-natured protest against suggestions that Pluto is not a planet. So it seems like there are a number of musicians who are out there and kind of feeling about this the same way that you are.
I hope that'll be the case.
The irony, of course, being that, as you mentioned, here it is, you know, one day they say Pluto is not a planet, and practically the next day, a brand new recording of your piece of Pluto is due out from Simon Rattle and the Berlin Philharmonic. What do you think you will do with the piece? Will you do a dwarf planet version? Will there be a chamber orchestration of this piece?
No, I think I'm going to leave it. I always thought that, you know, one extra movement was enough, and I think, you know, the piece is self-sufficient, and all I can say is it was officially a planet when I wrote it, and has been for 75 years.
All right, so the music then is grandfathered into the grand scheme of things.
Yes.
Colin Matthews, the English composer, has been my guest on Soundcheck, and Colin, we will look forward to the new recording of your piece next week. Thanks for being with us on Soundcheck today.
Thank you very much.
In a moment, Oliver Mutukudzi, the Zimbabwean singer and guitarist, combines popular protest with pop melodies. He'll play live in the studio. You're listening to Soundcheck. Thanks for listening to Soundcheck from WNYC, New York Public Radio. Each day we dig into what's happening in music, and you can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. All of this is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.